Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, is there a case to be made for fasting every few days? Could the stress of a day without much food on a regular basis not just toughen up our bodies, but our brains as well? New research into cells which just refuse to die and may make us age faster. And an important Australian study just published over the weekend in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. Its results give couples having trouble falling pregnant some pointed questions to ask their gynaecologist. It's the most thorough study to date of birth defects after what's called assisted reproduction, things like in vitro fertilisation, IVF, and sperm injection. Associate Professor Michael Davies is the lead author. He's in the Robinson Institute at the University of Adelaide, but spoke to me from Barcelona, where he's been presenting the findings.
Prior to this study, there had not been one which had actually considered all types of assisted conception simultaneously, together with freezing and thawing the embryo and then transferring a frozen embryo. In addition, we also compared the impact of having a singleton versus a multiple pregnancy.
What did you do in the study?
What we did was define a period between January 1986 and December 2002 and identified all births in the state of South Australia during that period, and were able to identify all births that were the consequence of assisted conception and link that to the birth defect registry. We then also allowed a full 5 years follow-up for every child. We also had access to all terminations as well, terminations for defect in the state. So we really had a comprehensive population-wide census of all births and their outcomes.
And what did you find?
There was a mixture of results. Once we started pulling apart the different modalities, we found that they actually produced very different sorts of pictures.
I mean, you say modalities, you're talking about the different techniques.
Yes, indeed. So each of the different treatments, and then within the treatments, whether it's a fresh and frozen cycle, for example, had different effects. So for IVF, for example, we found that the overall defect rate was extremely close to what colleagues had seen in Perth and then Sweden. But then when we adjusted for patient factors, things like maternal age and body composition, smoking and occupational exposures, that we found that we could actually largely explain the association with IVF.
So the excess was due to the fact that people who are going into assisted reproduction or IVF tended to be older and have other risk factors for infertility, which might also have been somehow toxic to the fetus.
Well, indeed, the technology added very little to that risk. And then also the process of then having an embryo going through a freeze-thaw cycle, again, didn't increase that risk at all. In fact, it tended to drop a couple more percentage points there.
So this was extraordinary that frozen embryos seemed to have a reduced risk. It seemed to be almost protective.
And in some way, that's not entirely surprising because it's a major challenge, depending on how the freeze-thaw cycle is done. Some proportion survive. For example, it might be 70%.
So the toughest survive.
The toughest, the most intact, the ones that have the greatest developmental potential.
Now it comes to intracytoplasmic sperm injection. I mean, these days, I mean, this is an historical series, but move forward 10 years to 2012. I mean, almost every assisted reproduction cycle in Australia now is done with intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where they inject the sperm into the egg, not leaving it to chance. And it's been a remarkable degree of relaxation amongst reproductive technologists about this, but I must say, I've always been concerned that this is probably the most unnatural part of assisted reproduction, and indeed you found a higher rate of birth defects that wasn't explained by other things.
You're quite right. There was a substantially higher birth defect rate associated with ICSI overall, as it's called as an acronym, but then that was particularly evident in the fresh ICSI cycle, and the effect of the freeze-thaw dragged that birth defect rate down. It was still elevated, but the...
Still plays to my prejudice that it's actually allowing men who were not destined to have children to have them.
Yes, indeed. One of the implications could be that there's a limit to the degree to which you can take a sperm that would have never had the capacity to fertilise an egg in nature, and you take that and fertilise an egg, and it's bypassing some of the selection pressures, because it's not allowing the egg to select which sperm it's fertilising. It's actually...
So the fittest does not necessarily get through.
It's not just the fittest, but it may also not be the one that's the best fit for that oocyte. There's also preparation practices for dealing with the sperm and the egg that are different, again, to IVF.
Were there particular types of defects here? I mean, what were the abnormalities that these children were born with?
Actually, the pattern is remarkably consistent in terms of the categories. We did notice, for example, as others, that there's categories of cardiovascular disease and gastrointestinal disease and musculoskeletal problems.
So give me a flavour of what sort of things you're talking about. Heart defects. Holes in the heart, ventricular septal defects, things like that?
Yes, and then also a treasure of parts of the intestinal tract, whether it be esophageal atresia or
so atresia abnormal narrowing of part of the bowel or absence of part of the bowel.
Yeah, and then also urogenital defects, hypospadias, for example, in boys.
So that's an abnormality of the penis.
Where the penis hasn't fused and closed properly.
What about neurological things like cerebral palsy or other problems?
We also notice a doubling in the risk of cerebral palsy, which is consistent also with a couple of other observations and, interestingly, ties up with some previous other reports of there being roughly a doubling or so of the incidence of monozygotic twinning, which occurs with ICSI.
So are you saying that the cerebral palsy risk comes from the twinning?
Well, there's some very interesting work that's come out of the UK in recent years by Peter Farrow, who did a follow-up of IVF patients there and then found that there was a strong correlation between the risk of monozygotic twinning and cerebral palsy, that he could trace it back to those extraordinarily early embryological states.
And what about preterm delivery? Was that increased?
Amongst the assisted conception group as a whole, there was a systematic disadvantage in terms of perinatal outcomes, roughly a doubling of stillbirth. And for the survivors, there was both for the twins and the singletons. They tended to be born earlier with a greater risk of premature birth, and they were born lighter, roughly 150 grams lighter or so, both of which are risk factors for long-term chronic disease risk.
Now, you can get spooked by some of this. I mean, the risks that you show here, even with ICSI, are not huge. So it's like a 1.7 odds or 1.8 odds risk. But really the implication for this is also, apart from the individual parent's dilemma, is the population health issue, because, you know, we're talking about tens of thousands of babies coming into the population as a result of these techniques with problems.
Globally, we're looking now at millions, perhaps 4 million to date. So, for example, the prevalence rate that we got for fresh ICSI was just under 10% major birth defect rate compared to 5.8% in the general population.
Well, I take back what I said. If there's a 1 in 10 chance of you having a baby with a birth defect, that's not inconsiderable.
Well, indeed, particularly if one considers that this treatment is entirely discretionary. There is perhaps an even greater sense of responsibility for ensuring that the treatment is safe.
I mean, the issue here is, what can you do about it?
There's two aspects of that, and you've alluded to one of those already, and that is that we shouldn't immediately jump at shadows here, because even with regard to ICSI, the youngest data are a decade old, and what's happened in the meantime is there's been extraordinary developments and refinements in the technology. The pregnancy rates have gone up extremely rapidly.
But that could be the birth defects going up as well.
Well, it could also mean that, in fact, the technology's improved and embryo quality's improved, so the defect rates may come down.
This shows remarkable religious faith here, Professor Davies, if I might
say
so.
Well, you know, I wouldn't quite put it that way, but what we do know is an association between early pregnancy viability and embryo viability, and then the...
So what you're saying is that this pregnancy success rate is a good proxy for higher quality outcomes.
Indeed, but the second component to it is that there is some good news in here as well, in that what we now have with regard to IVF is some assurance that IVF, particularly if we use single embryo transfer and then freeze the remaining embryos and return them at our leisure one at a time, that the babies from that strategy will have, as a group, no greater risk of birth defects than if they'd been spontaneously conceived by those parents.
Without ICSI.
Yeah.
So the consumer question to ask your obstetrician is about ICSI.
But then also there's a residual important research question there, which is, are there certain subtypes of semen defect that are associated with increased risk? Within ICSI, how much of the risk is due to certain types of sperm defect versus the treatment itself to do with how the gametes are manipulated? My interest in this is not just to improve the safety and effectiveness of assisted conception, but actually to take some lessons learned here about the early departures in growth development. So we have some lessons actually to apply to the population as a whole.
Such as?
So what are the circumstances that apply to men and women that actually enable them to have a healthy and happy family? Some of the follow-on work, for example, is that we're now going back upstream and looking at, for example, occupational exposures of the men and women in Australia, and then seeing how that relates in turn to reduced fertility as being in the causal pathway then to those families having a child with an abnormality.
And what occupational exposures do you think might be related here?
There may be estrogen disruptors, for example, operating in an environment, and there are certain drugs that are used in the ART, assisted reproductive technology clinics. One of the other major results we found in the paper was that women who use clomiphene citrate under poorly controlled circumstances had a tripling, greater than tripling in the risk of a major birth defect. Clomiphene is a drug that has been used for a very long time for ovulation induction. It's extremely cheap, but as we both noticed, and indeed in the US in a study at the beginning of 2011, they noticed that it was associated with an increase in urogenital defects. And this is of considerable interest to us because there's some 37,000 prescriptions of this per year under the pharmaceutical benefits scheme in Australia. And so we're intensely interested to find out the circumstance under which this is being administered and whether there's any irregularities. It's not a drug that a fetus wants to see.
Associate Professor Michael Davies is in the Robinson Institute at the University of Adelaide. I'm Norman Swan, and this is the Health Report here on RN.